Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Rafter Sass Ferguson, a PhD student at the University of Illinois whose doctoral thesis involves visiting and documenting 50 self-identified permaculture farms across the United States. Though that work and his upcoming field research form the body of our discussion, along the way we also touch on science literacy, permaculture education, crowdfunding of scientific research, permaculture and metaphysics, farms and financial permaculture, and his work as an agroecologist and how that informs his teaching and practice of permaculture. Quite a bit to cover in the 45 minutes or so of our conversation. If you'd like to learn more about Rafter and his work, first, take the time to listen to this interview as an introduction, and then delve in deep by visiting his website at liberationecology.org. Before we begin, a big thanks to James for his recent donation to the show. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support to find out how to make a donation and help the show along. New for 2013 is the option of a recurring monthly micropayment. If you value permaculture and having this information shared with others, take the time to help me continue to produce this show. Now, on to our time with Rafter. I'll join you again afterwards. Well then, Rafter, if you can give us a little bit of your background, how you came to permaculture, and then an introduction to your doctoral dissertation and the work that you've been doing, we can take the conversation from there.
Okay, great. Well, I didn't go to undergrad. I didn't go and get my bachelor's until my mid-20s, which wasn't based on sort of like really wise strategic planning, but ended up being a great decision because I didn't go until I really knew that I wanted to be there. And during that time, and I studied anthropology at Bard College in New York State. And during that time, I actually didn't study natural science very much at all and didn't really have much of an interest in the environment or in ecology. I was really more focused on social issues and on organizing around social justice. And it was after I finished my undergrad and sort of started getting out in the world and exploring a little bit more and doing a lot of traveling around the U.S. and seeing what was going on in different communities that I came into contact with, you know, particularly out on the West Coast, as it happens, with more and more folks for whom a sort of environmental analysis or an ecological critique of the system that we live in now was just much more important and had much more emphasis. And it was really appealing to me, but also a little bit unnerving. Because when I, for instance, I went to in that first summer after, you know, when I was turning 27, first summer after I finished my bachelor's, I went to an Earth First rendezvous on the West Coast and was sort of, you know, getting this primer in a very sophisticated environmental critique. And at the same time, was also hearing a lot of just sort of misanthropy and a lot of folks who were just like, well, humans are the problem. Humans are bad. We just need to limit the inherent destructiveness of humans. And so that didn't really mesh well with where I was coming from in terms of a really sort of like, how do we support communities in being healthy and determining their own future and sort of a really unabashedly pro people, up with people kind of politics. And it was right around that time when I actually started to hear about permaculture and had permaculture explained to me as a concept and a framework a few times. And it immediately struck me as something that was just really important and really powerful for reconciling this very strong ecological analysis of where we're at as a civilization and where we may be heading, with at the same time something that was very much, you know, not misanthropic, really put humans at the center of that picture, but in a much more sort of intelligent and nuanced way than you get in sort of, you know, these conventional ideas about economic growth and progress and development. And so I started seeking that out. The next year, actually went down to Latin America and spent some time for a few months traveling around in Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay, and took a permaculture design course, the 2-week intensive model, the permaculture design certificate course at an eco-village in Navarro in Argentina with a local teacher from that eco-village named Gustavo Ramirez and Peter Bain, who at that time was living in Earth Haven, North Carolina. And it really just kind of like blew the doors off. It was two gifted teachers, and the intensity of the 2-week sort of immersion program, it really affected how I was thinking about the work that I wanted to do in the world and where the sort of best tools and leverage points and strategies were for doing that work. And so that kind of became a jumping off point for me, and the next several years were structured around trying to put myself in contexts and communities and projects where I could continue learning about permaculture, sort of deepening my ecological analysis and my practical kind of applied ecology skills, and also doing a lot of work around trying to continue the process that I saw to be kind of implicit in permaculture of trying to bring together the strategies and the priorities that I brought with me from my experience in social justice movements, and say, how does the kind of whole systems integrative look that's coming out of permaculture, what would it be like to talk about social justice using a similar framework? And in 2005, I started developing and teaching and sharing a workshop curriculum that I called Liberation Ecology, which is still the name, the sort of umbrella term that I use for my work, and it's my website and so on. And actually spent a few years working on that before I sort of stepped into actually teaching permaculture. But shortly after, in 2007, I guess, I started putting myself out there as a permaculture teacher and designer. And over the course of those few years, found that I was just, deeply in love with teaching, that it was some of the most satisfying work that I'd ever done. And that I felt like I've found like a big piece of, maybe this is my calling, is doing this education work. And also at the same time, all along, had a sort of growing awareness and frustration with the chasm between permaculture and contemporary science. And, from my education in permaculture, what I came away with was the sense that science just didn't get permaculture, right? That there was this, that maybe it was an unbridgeable chasm, that permaculture was so far ahead of the curve that scientists and scientific institutions just move so slow and are so hidebound and have so many vested interests that they just can't get it. And that's sort of this one of the founding myths of permaculture, I think, that maybe had validity or had more validity in the late 70s when Mollison and Holmgren were sort of producing this framework, were doing this initial work of synthesis and development. But certainly over the intervening decades has become less and less true, although you still find, of course, everywhere in any major research institution, you find folks who will be hostile to the direction that permaculture is trying to go in. But you will also find many fellow travelers, whether or not they're aware of permaculture or are thinking of things using the vocabulary that permaculture uses, are very sympathetic and doing work that's really supportive. And I guess it was in 2008 that I decided that I actually wanted to go back to school to do some more natural science and to get a little bit more of that sort of solid toolkit under my belt. And, also because I thought it would help me earn a living. I was like, if I have a master's degree, and I'll be able to get paid a little bit more, or I'll be more desirable as a consultant, just trying to, make ends meet. And it seemed like a good way to spend a couple years and sort of make that investment. And while I was doing that, I went to University of Vermont at Burlington, got to study with amazing pioneer ecological designer, John Todd, and studied agroecology and did research on sort of participatory design frameworks for incorporating perennial polycultures into the landscapes of existing farms, and had a pretty great time. And as hard as grad school is, and grad school is, can be pretty hard. And at the same time, started realizing just like how much of a need there was for bringing permaculture itself into the sort of ongoing conversation in the scientific community. And so ultimately decided to come to continue to do my PhD and came here to University of Illinois. And here I began really approaching permaculture proper as an agroecologist and saying, okay, now what's going on here as a movement, as a set of practices, as a design framework? How can we relate this to the persistent ongoing questions in the scientific conversation and, you know, move this conversation forward?
The path that you've taken to get where you are seems very reminiscent of the point that I've come to in my life, because I'll be here in a couple of weeks, be starting graduate school for environmental education. And in looking at my long-term plans after that, as my wife keeps putting her foot on my bum and kicking me down the road to take that to the level of a PhD, because we need more people who are at that level who can engage both academia and the public to bring this system of design both into the mainstream, but also to bring then the science literacy of academia into permaculture, so that we can, if you will, if you've seen some of the conversations about permaculture and metaphysics, or getting the woo out of permaculture, to bring some of that together so that, at least in the United States, where we haven't had the need for it yet, that permaculture can be more mainstream and openly accepted, so that we're working with more scientists as colleagues and not in competition with them where they're looking down on or poo-pooing this idea of permaculture. So with your work in looking at permaculture as an agroecologist, as I understand it, you're documenting self-identified permaculture farms across the United States?
That's the project. And my field research won't begin for a few months yet. And so what's been my active research projects so far has been, in terms of the U.S. Permaculture Farms Project, has been, well, the most important moment actually came in the sort of previous research project that when I did an international survey of permaculturists this past summer, which was the first of its kind, which is kind of hard to believe, but it's true as far as I can tell that there's been no sort of systematic survey of, okay, who's doing permaculture and what's it mean when they say they're doing permaculture, and had over 1,000 responses from over 40 countries, which is, you know, so it's a mountain of data. And what I discovered in looking at that data was that of U.S. respondents, that around 10% were reporting farming as a significant source of income. This was a big surprise, because I suspect a fairly widely held assumption in the U.S. permaculture community that I know that I've shared with even some notable leaders and authors in U.S. permaculture, that there just aren't really permaculture farms in the U.S. We've got lots of, you know, we've got a ton of gardens, of course, and we've got a lot of educational projects. And, you know, we've got a variety of things where there's some kind of production going on, but there's not, but there aren't farms. And so when I saw that, I was like, well, this is news. This is a big deal. And so I actually started looking for permaculture farms, doing sort of like hours of iterative and pretty tedious internet searches, and putting a page up on my website where if you were aware of a permaculture identified farm, you could refer me to them, and queries to all these regional and national and international listservs, and started putting together a list. And the list is now at about 160. And so following on that, the next step is to say, okay, you say there's these 160 permaculture farms. What do we mean by permaculture in this case? And also, what do we mean by farm? Because lots of things get called farm that might actually be a school or a bed and breakfast or something else entirely. So I've been administering a really short survey that's just intended to assess the sort of scale of production, like how farm is this farm, and also the level of identification with permaculture, because permaculture can sometimes be just one buzzword that's being used among many. And I have almost 100 responses to that preliminary survey so far. And just the sort of first look at that data is really exciting, because there's these farms in a variety of contexts at a variety of scales of production that are reporting that permaculture is influencing not only the design of their farm landscape, which is what the sort of hope to see that, but also, you know, their fertility management, their pest and pathogen management, their selection of crops, their selection of enterprises. So there's a lot of farms in the U.S. I mean, you know, a really small number of the total, but so many more than I had previously assumed, where their involvement with permaculture is really making an impact on what they're doing in the landscape. And so from the farms who respond to that short survey and say that they're interested in further research, I will pull a pool of a sample of 50 farms out of that at you know, three or four different sort of scales or levels of production, farm size, and try and visit all 50 of those, and then do just a more in-depth look. Okay, now, how is this farmer responding to, you know, sort of taking the permaculture principles and design tools, and then assessing their site, responding to local social conditions, local markets, and the landscape, and selecting and, you know, configuring all these different enterprises and patches and land uses in the landscape. And what can we see happening as a result? What are the outcomes of this approach? I'm very excited because it's an opportunity to separate out permaculture and what's distinctive about permaculture, which is the design framework, from all the sort of approaches to farming that are doing a lot of similar practices. I mean, and they're doing, there's lots of diverse organic farms who are doing fantastic stuff. But try and see, like, how is permaculture itself influencing what's happening in the landscape, right? How do these ideas get translated into particular contexts and particular sites? And then what happens as a result?
Many of the concepts and ideas that are wrapped up in permaculture, as you say, with diverse organic farms, we have rotational grazing, we have intercropping, alley cropping, and all of these different techniques that come across different lines of production. How do you distinguish the work that the individual farms that you plan to visit is practicing permaculture? Do you want to identify and look at the techniques that they're using on site? Is it a matter of analyzing the design that they've put into the farm? How do you make that distinction between the different types of farming versus permaculture?
I'm not interested in making a sort of hard distinction there, but because I want to see what the impact of the permaculture framework as carried by the permaculture movement is, as I want to see characterize what's happening as a result of that, my real criterion over what I'm including, you know, whether it's permaculture or not, is really how strong an influence the farmer reports permaculture has been. So it's not, I'm not going to look at particular practices on a farm and sort of pronounce, okay, this farm over here is doing permaculture, but this one's not. What I want to see is we have easy access through all the books and the websites to what permaculture says about itself, right? We know what permaculture is advocating for. We know what, you know, what we're advocating for as permaculturists, that when that conversation, when that framework and worldview touches down on a working farm, then what happens?
So that becomes then your survey is about, we have all these books, all this literature, all this information. What is it that people who self-identify as permaculture farmers are implementing on an active working farm to bridge the difference between someone who's gardening on a small scale versus the theory in the material, or what actually works on the ground as a productive farmer?
Right. Yeah. I expect to be surprised in multiple ways because we have, you know, in our national agricultural policy, particularly the policy programs like Conservation Stewardship Program and Conservation Reserve Program and, you know, EQIP, we have embedded in those policies these sort of official definitions of what good practice is and what sustainability is. And I expect to find in permaculture farms a lot of practice that contradicts some of that official policy, because that official definition is really informed largely by a vision of sustainability that's still really organized around, you know, large-scale commodity production, which is not very multifunctional. So I expect to see in practice permaculture farms have differences both with sort of like official definitions of sustainability and with the sort of ideal permaculture theory. There's going to be some other thing that's happening on the ground that's going to be really distinctive. And that's what I'm excited to see, because there's a way in which the permaculture movement as a whole is starved for feedback. It sort of boggles the mind that, you know, 35 odd years in, that there's never been a systematic multi-site analysis of permaculture as an approach to production scale food growing. And so it's time to see what's really happening.
I can certainly agree with that, as I did a survey of some of the literature that I have here on permaculture, and as you start reading it, it becomes self-referential.
Incredibly so.
And you're like, oh, there are all these great references to this, this, and this, and then you pull out another book, and then you're like, oh, this is just earlier material. Where's the study that produced this? I've personally kind of come to a crossroads because there's the scientist inside of me, because before I went off to the university the first time, I had studied all the hard scientists very in-depth, physics, chemistry, everything, biology, and was very well versed in science. And then I went to something originally to be a sociologist and an anthropologist, but of course there was a conversation, but what are you going to do with that? So I became a computer scientist, which of course, when you study something that has science in the name, of course it's not a science. So some of that went by the wayside, but I looked at it and I go, you know, it doesn't matter whether this is science or not. It makes a nice paycheck.
Uh-huh.
But now as I get more fully back into the realm of permaculture, and I'd like to see more of that research. I want to see those kinds of numbers so that we don't have these practices that are 30 or 40 years old that get parroted because they've been there for so long, that they've become, well, Bill Mollison warns us against dogma. Yet at the same time, I feel that some of the conversations that we have in the permaculture community have become dogmatic, that we do A, B, and C because that's what we've always done. Well, is that the right choice? Is that the good solution?
Yeah.
And if we're going to do more permaculture work that is more widely accepted, then let's find out what the most current ideas are, get rid of the dross, and put something together that's leaner, meaner, and easier to implement. And with the numbers that show that doing multifunction can have the productivity that some master gardeners and some of the people in the biointensive movement are showing, that gardening on a small scale can feed 8 to 10 people per acre. Well, we need more research that shows that.
When I talk about my emphasis on, I want to look at permaculture farms, I should be really clear that I'm not dismissing the power of gardening, the power of home-scale permaculture, home-scale food production. I think that's great. And there's actually, you know, if you look at the literature, particularly some of the development literature for the Global South, there's plenty of research showing that home gardens can have fantastic effects on food security and, you know, human nutrition. There's no need to, because I'm interested in looking at the sort of larger scale production-oriented agroecosystems, that doesn't mean that I think that gardens aren't cool.
For me, it's that knowing some of these numbers on the small scale is wondering, how does this scale up to production? Because until, I think it was Eric Tonesmeyer who said it to me, was that at the time when he and I first spoke, you were just starting down the road of doing your survey and you had identified like 80 sites, I think he mentioned. Your additional information is close to 100. And what I have from there is, what kind of scale are we talking about for acreage or just land in production that these farms are using?
That's a fairly wide range. And the sort of categories I made available only went up to 100 plus. We definitely have farms, multiple farms clocking in at 100 plus acres. And the most populated category of farm size is in the 2 to 5 acre size, the 2 to 5 acre category. So there's definitely a strong emphasis on, you know, small intensive systems. But, you know, particularly when you're getting over 2 acres, you know, that's definitely a production oriented system. That would be a really ungainly home garden. And in the, you know, preponderance of farms at that smaller scale is in many ways reflective of what's happening in the agricultural sector in the U.S. generally. While most of our food is grown on huge farms, most of our farmers are farming small farms. Their contribution is just currently swamped by all the food that's being produced by these huge industrial factory farms. The sort of renaissance of new farmers and young farmers coming into getting access to land and starting CSAs or starting, you know, using other business models, I think renaissance is really the right word for it. All this new interest, the new generation of farmers, you know, that's the vast majority of that in and out of the permaculture sector is happening on pretty small plots.
When I go to my local farmers markets and get to know some of my local farmers and talk to them, I'm finding that the majority of the work that's being done here in the central Pennsylvania region is on 20 acres or less. That those large-scale farms just aren't what people have access to anymore. Particularly here, where I am, some land can run $100,000 or more an acre. And I'm not far from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. The Amish population, a lot of farming occurs down there, and I know farmers who are getting bought out by developers for $70,000 or $80,000 an acre. They've got several hundred acres. It's easy for them to sell when they look at that kind of money. And the availability of land for many beginning farmers, you just don't have, in some areas, at least here in the East, access to large scale. So I can see that as being the direction we're headed for people who want to get involved in this kind of work.
And it really starts to get at sort of something I've been writing about lately, just a little bit on the blog, and something that I'm going to be actually getting to teach with Eric in Miami in a week and a half at the financial permaculture course being put on by the folks at Financial Permaculture and at Earth Learning in Miami, that permaculture farmers and permaculture enterprises of all kind, and certainly lots of different folks trying to do sustainable agriculture, but permaculture farmers in particular face this very tricky contradiction of needing and wanting to do something that is regenerative, that's, you know, good for community and good for the soil, good for the ecosystem. And so wanting to demonstrate, to model a system that's pointing towards a really different way of doing things than the kind of green revolution model we and the free market capitalism model that we've been enmeshed in for a while. And so they're trying to create these enterprises that are sort of like a picture of a future way of doing things, that they're deeply regenerative. And at the same time, these enterprises also have to be able to thrive right now while they're enmeshed in this totally degenerative socioeconomic system. And that's a very tricky path to navigate. And so these small farms are having much more diversified systems that are much more complex in space and time. They're they're both diverse in the landscape and diverse enterprises, and also are often incorporate perennial features. So the yields of the system are changing over time. And they have very few business planning tools that are built to accommodate that kind of complexity. And so often end up winging it, and sometimes are able to bring together a few different tools and sort of integrate them and patch them together and come up with a business plan that way. And so that's just within the farm, the challenge of doing economic planning for a diversified, complex system. And then beyond the farm boundaries, once their products leave, they're competing with cheap industrial food that's produced on these very large-scale systems that are totally monofunctional. They're optimized just for high yield and nothing else, and are often relying on exploited labor, and are either implicitly or explicitly subsidized by fossil fuels, by cheap energy, and the wars that we fight to secure it, and by the ability to just completely degrade the ecosystem that they're a part of. And so you can produce more food a lot cheaper. I'm doing air quotes around cheaper. You can't see them. But if you ignore all the externalities. And so one of the reasons that I expect to see that permaculture farms are not going to look like a page taken out of the permaculture designer's manual, right? We're going to see lots of ways in which there are compromises made between the perfect, ideal, imaginary permaculture farm and the present day socioeconomic system, because we are in the position of having to sort of building the future right now, but the future also has to survive the present.
So the model that you expect to see as you go visit these farms on the ground is a transitional one, somewhere between the standard models that we have now for production agriculture, moving towards a more regenerative one within permaculture, but because of needing to exist within the current world as it is, not as the farmers wish it to be, or some of us might hope that it would be, that you can only accomplish so much within those restrictions.
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm hoping to see is, what is the distinctive, because, you know, to back up just a second, you know, the description that you just made is also a description of, in many ways, everyone who's trying to do sustainable agriculture, you know, all the fabulous organic farmers out there who would like to be doing things one way and are making compromises in how they do it. And what I'm hoping to see is, what is the distinctive sort of thumbprint of permaculture on that process, right? What is permaculture bringing to the table? And I suspect it's bound up with, you know, this array of sort of analysis and design tools that is really the core, the distinctive core of permaculture, in terms of how do we think spatially about the components and the elements of the landscape, and how do we design the relationships between those? Because it's not just what we do, it's where we do it, and it's the relationship between the different things that we're doing. It's the relationship between our pasture and our orchard and our surface water and all the different land uses that we have. How's the permaculture framework helping farmers think through that spatial reasoning process, that creative process in the landscape, and create systems that, just by the arrangement of the features in the landscape, help to minimize labor and maximize, you know, multiple functions?
I've had the opportunity to visit some sustainable farms, and the description that you just provided me makes me think about how a permaculture farm may look like any farm that someone may visit, that it's going to be in the conversation with the farmer and understanding their design process that really picks out the elements that make that farm different from what you might find elsewhere. That it may not readily be visible to us when we walk around the farm without a permaculture framework in mind, to be looking for those relationships and identifying the tools that may have been used to design that layout.
Yeah. I mean, I also think in some cases it will jump out at you. But it depends on the context and the age of the farm and how long permaculture has been being used as a framework for that farm. But I do think that, yeah, in many cases there will be important distinctions and important impacts that won't be readily obvious, that'll actually be more subtle, and which is, you know, if you think about the permaculture emphasis on observation and responding to the existing relationships in the landscape and the existing processes, you would hope that actually a lot of that subtlety would be leveraged and would be incorporated into the design. And so these farmers are going to show me a lot of things that aren't going to be apparent to me just as I walk onto the site. That's what I imagine. But I'm pretty confident about that.
We are reminded continually within the world of permaculture that every site is unique, and so is the design that goes with it. And I'm fascinated to think about everything that you will see when you are out doing your tour of these farms. When you are done putting all of this together, will your dissertation be publicly available if someone went to your website to look at your research and everything that you found?
Yeah, absolutely. That's very important to me. My trajectory, the way that I think about, you know, the path that I'm on with my life is not to come through permaculture and get really excited and then leave permaculture and go into science and then just study permaculture from academia, but to sort of stay in that relationship and to have the work that I do provide useful feedback and information to folks who are out there in the trenches. In particular, my relationship with the public and the relationship between my research and the public, particularly the permaculture public, but not only, is actually not just what inspires me, but it's also part of what's helping make my research possible. Working through a group called SciFund Challenge, I did a crowdfunding campaign to support my field research because there's going to be a lot of travel, and raised about $8,000, which was about $3,000 over my goal, from the general public, from people who understand what I'm trying to do and want to help make it happen. And a lot of that came from within the permaculture community. And part of my commitment in doing that, part of what I commit to doing in as I ask for that support, is all of my research outputs will be publicly available I'll either publish in, you know, the scholarly publications will either be in open access journals, or I'll make preprints and draft copies available for free over the internet. I'll be producing a summary report of this research project, which will be made, ultimately will be made available for free download. I continue to work as a permaculture educator, and now in particularly sort of in this niche as an agroecologist and permaculture educator. And I will continue to incorporate all of this work and everything that I learn into all my work as a doing popular education. That's the whole reason for this.
So your scholarly work then will inform your living curriculum as a public instructor, as a teacher to other permaculture practitioners, to students who come to you as you teach a PDC or other material. The work that you're doing, your work as an agroecologist, will change the work that you're doing in that realm as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it has already. I teach a permaculture design course each summer with Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute in Ithaca, New York. And they're a great group of teachers and organizers, and I have a fantastic time working with them. And it's been extremely valuable for me over the last 4 years of seeing how, you know, what I'm doing and how I teach evolves as I get further into my life as a scientist, I guess, get more skills, more of these sort of like analytical and research skills, and also just more of a sort of thorough grounding in the ecological science that's behind, and the social science actually that's behind so much agroecology. And following on this research, so this informs my, you know, my teaching in formats like that, and in the financial permaculture course this month in Miami, but also in new formats where I'm going to be creating curriculum that is specifically for farmers, because this research, this on-farm research, you know, one of the real intended audiences for it is for permaculturists who are considering farming and farmers who are considering permaculture, to provide some of that sort of systematic analysis that right now is missing from all our materials, right? So what's working in different contexts? What enterprises are combining well, right? Because we've started thinking, you know, there's plenty of work to do, but we've at least started thinking really carefully about, you know, what plants grow well together, right? So thinking about polycultures within kingdoms or between kingdoms, but also different farm enterprises that sort of like creating polycultures on that level. So what enterprises and combinations of enterprises are working well in what ecological and economic contexts throughout the U.S.? Ultimately, I want to know, I want to have those questions answered at a global level, but that might not be my work. And in any event, this is a good start.
I'm looking at nothing because we're recording a radio interview, which isn't really a radio. Oh. This is a picture of a painting of a pipe. Actually, it's a drawing of a picture of a painting of a pipe that was printed in a book. Yeah. all the levels of extraction. No, I think over the work that you're doing and that idea of the polycultures and the way then that relates to the polycultures within business. And as we develop these relationships between perhaps on farm or between the farmer and someone on the outside and the work that they're doing, the way that that can also inform the skills that are necessary to utilize certain niches within a community, and how that can be used then also to find other resources that a farmer can use that doesn't put them in competition with their neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
I love these conversations because I'm left with so much more information than I ever imagined. It's a common theme whenever I interview someone. I love this process. And I hope the listeners do as well, and each one of them can take something away from this conversation. There's so much here. So, from here, how long do you think that it will take before you have your survey and your work done that people can be reading about?
I'm hoping to finish all the field research in 2013. So that's, you know, 50 farms. And I hope to finish my PhD by spring of 2014. So in a spring or summer of 2014, I should say. And so in about a year and a half, I would like to begin, if I haven't already begun, I would like to be producing, you know, some of these summary reports and getting them out there. In the meantime, I will continue to blog about and to give reports on my research and on sort of related topics in permaculture and agroecology and political ecology at liberationecology.org. And so there will be a lot of sort of stories from the field. So it's not, folks who are interested in this project don't have to wait for a year and a half and then it all gets released at once. It'll be more of an ongoing process.
I always like to digest things in one big sitting. So I'll look forward to everything in 2014 as this comes together, and certainly to have you back on to discuss your findings. Before we draw this interview to a close, is there anything else that you'd like to share with the listeners about your work, specifically about permaculture in general?
Well, there was, you know, something that you mentioned earlier, which is a really interesting topic of the question of the sort of role of metaphysics and of woo in permaculture. And I feel more than one thing about this, because on one hand, I'm really drawn to empirical science, and I'm a little bit allergic to sort of first world woo. And so my, you know, in the spectrum that exists in permaculture between folks who are really, you know, unabashedly, it's an eco-spiritual approach for them, to, I'm sort of at the other end of the spectrum of, like, I'm a materialist, I'm a natural and a social scientist, and so I'm not, that's not my approach. But at the same time, we have to acknowledge that in the absence of direct, concrete evidence in support of permaculture over the last 35 years, right, because we haven't had this research, the reason that permaculture has been able to spread is because of the sort of ecological worldview that it's sharing and the way in which that has resonated with the way people, you know, what people were looking for and how people have been, like, trying to find words for. Some of that metaphysical stuff and some of that woo is part of that worldview. I don't know if I can sort of draw a line in the sand and say, okay, this side of the worldview is science and then this side is all woo, right? Particularly when there hasn't been that hardcore scientific support for permaculture over time. And so when we look at traditional ecological knowledge all over the world, you know, one of the things, and when, you know, a lot of traditional and indigenous societies, as you might imagine, have these incredibly sophisticated land management practices that get better results than what's coming out of scientific institutions. And for all those traditional societies, you know, people who are doing development studies and anthropology, what they find in looking at traditional ecological knowledge is that worldview matters. All of that practical and technical knowledge is interwoven with metaphysical perspective. And so I feel really torn about this issue. And I know for myself, I'm going to keep teaching as a scientist, right? And I'm going to keep doing developing curricula that emphasize a materialist perspective, not, you know, materialism in the sense of just we're not talking about spirituality for the most part. And at the same time, I'm unsure of, I think maybe the move to get rid of the woo might be a little bit of insecurity about how little science we've done, and that we could actually just build our scientific foundation, and that we actually don't have to worry about folks having more of a spiritual, like, take on permaculture. It's not necessarily a conflict. We could, like, work on developing our strength rather than trying to banish something that seems like a liability. Maybe that wasn't the closing note that you were...
No, that's not it at all. I'm rolling that over because I'm considering, I've also spent time, as I say, I've studied cultural anthropology and archaeology and sociology, and I think about the way that myth informs our worldview. Mm-hmm. The way that storytelling, because we are storytellers. Mm-hmm. It's, as an interviewer, in this context, it's strange for me because of how much I sit back and listen to my guest so that your voice is what comes through and it's your story. Mm-hmm. But when I'm in a social group, it's the gregariousness, the storytelling. There's I have to go from A to F to Z to get back to the point that was made at B, because there's this long rambling kind of way to get there. The story of my introduction to permaculture is this web of different points that have to be connected before an answer can be given. Mm-hmm. And I can look at, not look at again, because we're talking, I can listen to the words that you said and think about the context for someone to integrate this information into their own lives in a way that's meaningful by using what others might consider woo or the metaphysical. Mm-hmm. Or at the same time, sitting down and doing a visualization exercise to guide someone through the implications of climate change. Mm-hmm. Well, is guiding someone through a meditative process or a visualization process something metaphysical? Is it this, well, the woo, as I say, or is that then just a method of teaching, a way of telling a story to share information? And I think that we could have a long conversation on the metaphysical and storytelling and myth and legend and indigenous knowledge and the way that that relates to the understanding of permaculture, mm-hmm. and where those lines are.
And the politics of that also, because there's capacity of folks in the industrialized world to make claims about indigenous knowledge and or to take on some, you know, indigenous belief systems or aspects of it is actually something that's pretty fraught and is not always given the careful ethical consideration that it needs in and out of the permaculture movement.
I feel like we've just opened a subject that we should talk, that we should have a discussion about sometime, go back and forth, put it together, and maybe we'll do some raw audio or some limited editing on for folks who might be interested in it. It's certainly a conversation that I would love to have.
Yeah.
Because it's something that crosses my mind, and it's why, though people won't hear it, there was a long gap there between the time that you ended and I started speaking again, was just because of how heavy the implication is. And trying to, within my own mind, start with that big picture and parse out the pieces of it. Some serious things there for all of us to understand and consider at some point. But now that we've gotten to there, any short last thoughts before we bring everything to a close?
Just this has been great, and we should do it again sometime, Scott.
I certainly want to. There's quite a bit that we touched on in here that I would like to revisit. So I think we will again sometime. Rafter, thank you so much for joining me for this interview.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Rafter Sass Ferguson, agroecologist, permaculture practitioner, and PhD student, discussing his upcoming research, among many other ideas. One of the elements I'm interested in seeing from his work is what theoretical practices of permaculture get applied to working farms that use this design process to inform the decision-making required to blend permaculture and farming into a productive, financially viable whole. In the show notes, you'll find a link to Rafter's website, liberationecology.org, and the SciFund challenge that he used to crowdfund his field research. Do you know anyone who'd be interested in Rafter's work and the results as he moves forward? Do you know someone who's farming with permaculture? Are you someone who's farming with permaculture? I'd love to hear about your experiences of applying these designs to your efforts. Leave a note on the webpage for this episode, or send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call on the voicemail line, 717-827-6266. Before we draw this to a close, unrelated to permaculture, in this episode I made a remark about this is a drawing of a picture of a painting of a pipe. That bit of dialogue is a paraphrase from Scott McCloud's book, Understanding Comics. If you're interested in communicating through visual means, I recommend picking up a copy and giving it a read. Though almost 20 years old at this point, there's a lot of very useful information about how to communicate effectively in the comic book form. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.